body. A dog with a kind of merry curiosity about the world. And this tension about what I was going to do was very much part of the last 4 months in which I've been writing this paper. So since February, I've been working in the archives. I've gone through the last 100 years of criminal court cases. Isn't it marvelous what you can do on sabbatical? I've gone through, honestly, 100 years. It's well over 1,000 pages of archival material. And it's murder. And it's commissions of inquiry by the state. And it's police reports coming from the top brass, but also the detective constables on the bottom. And at the same time, every day in the newspapers, I've been following these two emblematic crimes against women that really got to me. And while all this is going on, I'm living with a pack of 13 dogs in my bedroom, writing things. So this is where this paper comes from. But now to return sensibly to the historical record. How did dogs become the signifiers of, anxieties and stereotypes that blacks and whites have of each other in South Africa? Especially the fear of which so many witnesses have spoken. The African fear of the white dog, the terror of the police dog. And here I should say something about violence and viscerality in my talk. South Africa's history should come with its own trigger warning, and this talk will touch topics that hurt. But I'm going to do that because I think that's the nature of history that matters in a country in crisis. So I've started going through the 7 volumes of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there's scores of references to dogs. Dogs appear as part of the narrative of oppression, as powerful instruments and agents of the technocratic apartheid state. As Kanjo Majumbo said, dogs are relics of our complicated history. They're complicit in the apartheid agenda. The breed of choice, the German Shepherd, had a special appetite for black African flesh. Anti-apartheid and struggle artist, who's excellent, Willy Bester, he did a 2001 exhibition where he used dogs as a kind of, like a blunt refusal to erase the past horror of racial injustice. And the articulation of his police dogs' bolted joints, the heavy weight of their bones, and the jagged perfection of their teeth is really about suggesting the brute power of the state. And what Bester was referencing, and he actually showed as a kind of film in the gallery, was an incident that had happened, a very disturbing incident from 1998. Now, 1998 was only, it was 4 years after the fall of apartheid. But what happened was 6 white policemen from the South African police force captured 3 illegal immigrants from Mozambique, and they used the immigrants as live bait on which to train their police dogs. And this was shown on, I show it. This was shown on TV, of course, and then it was showed around the world. And it outraged and shamed South Africa. And it made people sharpen debate on how to reform the police. Because other things were going on. Dogs were disobeying their handlers. Dogs were savaging suspects. Dogs were having to be kept in cages. They were not being socialized with humans and other dogs. So in 2000, while the Mozambique refugee case was breaking the headlines, an international police dog trainer, Hans Schergel of the Swiss Canine Training School, came out and said that police dog training in South Africa was rotten to the core. He said that the dogs were too psychologically sick to be rehabilitated. He said they are trained on fear. They've got no trust in human beings. He said it's based on a racist program predicated on the fear of dogs by Africans. And he said it's 50 years behind Europe. He maintained that South Africa needed a new breed of human dog handler. And he also said we needed new puppies. He said that the existing corps of police dogs should simply be killed so that we could start fresh with dogs that had never known apartheid. So, to understand what happened here, we need to go back 100 years. We need to go back to 1911, to the very start of the South African police force. What happened was, we became independent from Britain in 1910, and the very next year, they set up an independent policing, one force for the country. and they amalgamated all the other arms of service, you know, into this one policing force. And one of the first things they did was the great experiment using dogs in detection. And dogs had been used in Natal, you know, in the English side on the East Coast, spectacularly unsuccessfully. There was a dog called Rex, who was a bloodhound. He was very, very bad, but they used him. And they thought, it was all inspired by one guy that I'll come to, but at the opening of the brand new police dog program in 1912, there were just 13 dogs. And in fact, there were really 5 dogs and 8 puppies. The police set up a training facility in Irene, in Pretoria, on Jan Smuts's farm. And the idea was that they were going to train the dogs at the central base and then send trained dogs out, always operating in pairs, with one particular dog handler attached to that pair that had been trained with them, and then spread out all in the rural bases around the Union of South Africa. And it was all under one guy, a man called Cornelius Kuiper, who was a dog master. And he was an expat from Holland. He'd come out in 1897. And he was not a young man, he was in his 50s, but he was a man of passion and conviction. So things started happening. 2 years into the program, they bought 6 dogs from Holland at an enormous cost of £300. In those 2 years, those dogs were called out, I think, on 47 cases. That's one every 2 weeks. They were successful in 27, and the conviction rate was only 6 cases. So people didn't really know, I think that's what I've got from the archive. So people didn't really know what this dog evidence was all about, or what was it for. That was going to change very, very fast. Over time, they developed this intensive 12-month training program, beginning for each puppy at 4 months of age. And the emphasis was on teaching obedience, the climbing over obstacles, walls, jumping over obstacles, jumping through windows. The point was to create a dog that was solely an aid in detection, not in any sense for protection of the policeman, not in any sense for attack. After the basics were in place, the dog was trained to follow human scent and then trained in how to do an identification parade. The dog master Cornelius Kuiper explained, in this the dog picks out with almost uncanny accuracy one person whose scent he has been given from an identification lineup of 6 to 10 persons. He was taught to run from one end of the line to the other, and only on the return trip pick out his man, standing on his hind legs with the 4 paws on the culprit's shoulder and barking until called off by the dog handler, which they called the dog keeper. At the start of the 20s, they had 65 trained tracker dogs. By 22, they had 73. By 1928, they had 200 dogs spread out across the Union. And they kept buying good noses from Holland and then breeding their own, first at Irene in Pretoria, then in this place called Quaggespoort. Only a South African can say Quaggespoort. Or maybe a Glaswegian. I've come to the place where they can say Quaggespoort. So nice. In fact, the newly minted Union government became involved in the sex life of dogs on a ministerial level. In 1912, the Secretary for Justice was told that the police bitch, Bosco, was expecting her first litter of puppies, and the dog master judged by her bulging tummy that the litter would be large. So ministerial approval, that's how big the great experiment was in their minds. Ministerial approval had to be granted for the purchase of an Airedale bitch to aid as a foster mother to help Bosco raise her puppies. And this kind of detail is ethnographic gold. But to write the kind of, you know, truly multi-species social history, we do need a lot more Clifford Geertzian thick descriptions. I think these will come with oral testimonies. But we can get a lot out of the archive. For example, we know that by 1928, dogs were allowed, they didn't have to finish, but they were allowed 1 pound of meat or 1 pound of cereal a day, but they were no longer allowed to get any dog biscuits. Getting too fat. We also know exactly how their kennels were built, out of slate and wood and brick. We know how they looked. We also know that Cornelius Kuiper started experimenting on the best breeds. He thought, tried Dobermans, Rottweilers, German Shepherds, Rhodesian Ridgebacks, which had only been invented as a breed in 1922. And then finally, Cooper decided on the recipe for a good police dog. It's a Doberman Pinscher with a dash of Rottweiler, but it mustn't be more than 25% Rottweiler. The Rottweiler settled the Doberman and made him more reliable on identity parades. And Cooper was particularly impressed by a Rottweiler that he saw in Holland called Max von Strahlenberg. He wrote in an official report, "My heart beats with pleasure when I hear of the work done by Strahlenberg's nose." So he couldn't afford Max von Strahlenberg. So he bought Flora, who was pregnant with Max's babies, and brought her to South Africa. And there's case after case after case after case of how these dogs are put into operation. One that really struck me was Bosco. You remember Bosco? She had put motherhood behind her and rejoined active duty. And she was used in a murder case in 1922 in my town, in my little university town of Stellenbosch, little town surrounded by mountains, where a Bosco sniffed out an African man had been murdered, and she sniffed out his killers, Amos Ngotsi and George Mashlamana, who were sentenced to 7 years hard labor on Bosco's testimony. Now, having gone through the criminal cases, this is real. Having gone through the criminal cases, there are a surprising number of confessions. And I think there are three reasons for this. The first one is maybe the impact of forensic science. It was impressive to people. The police reports, you know, they're full of a kind of wonder. It's done with the slow typing punctiliousness of the true policeman, but there's awe and there's wonder at how the dogs were doing. They talk about, from 200 yards to 6 miles the dog tracked the spore. The spore, you know, the scent that's connected to the track. The spore is maybe 8 hours to maybe 32 hours old. People were impressed. And it bursts out of the bureaucratic language of the police reports. And maybe to the alleged perpetrators, it also seemed almost pointless to defy the science. Certainly the Commissioner of Police, Colonel Trutter, believed that blacks were so impressed by the uncanny knowledge possessed by the dogs that they spontaneously confessed of their crimes. But that brings us to a darker reason, reason two. It's totally possible that if the police themselves were convinced by the power of smell, that confessions may have been extracted by violence, a technique not unknown to the South African police. And that also makes me think about reason number three, which is a much more interesting possible reason. And that was suggested contemporaneously by the top level Commissioner Trutter to the dog master, Cornelius Cooper. And that reason was witchcraft. And certainly as early as 1913, Cornelius Cooper, the dog master, said, "The moral effect has been very great, especially among the natives, who call them witch dogs." So it's possible that in the popular imagination, police dogs may have replaced witch doctors in the occult art of smelling. And it must be clearly understood how alive witchcraft was in the first half of the 20th century. In fact, in South Africa, it is still alive. Even today, there are frequent reports. My father used to track them before he died, gave him something to do in his retirement. He used to track the police reports and the newspaper reports on witchcraft killings in South Africa. And even today, every month or so, there is some liminal and marginal, normally old person up in Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and KwaZulu-Natal, who is murdered by the community for being a witch. But in the 1920s, it was pandemic. Remember, it was a time of great social dislocation, political conquest by the white minority, land dispossession of the African majority, following the ruthless and racist 1913 Land Act. It was also a time of disease, a time of the Rinderpest, a time of the little understood great influenza. It was a time of strangeness and fear. And of course, indigenous healing practices had been misunderstood and outlawed by the colonial authorities in the 19th century and then by the state in the 20th century. And the authorities ruthlessly attacked the Isangoma. Now, it must be understood that the Isangoma were witch doctors, not witches. The Isangoma were healers or diviners, whereas the witches were something different. And You know, they were, the Isangoma were ruthlessly suppressed under the witchcraft suppression laws in 1910 and 1957. And these laws drove a wedge between black and white communities, Africans arguing that the colonial state had actually aligned itself with the witches in suppressing the Isangoma. On the other side, the state used witchcraft as proof of the irrational and superstitious nature of Africans, which almost seemed to buttress the need for the colonial rule of law. So here's how it worked. We can't have this while this is happening. So here's how it worked. And this is taken from, this is how the police dogs got to the crime scene. But here's how it worked, the Isangoma and the smelling art, as delineated in a classic 1936 text, anthropological text by Aline Kricher. Witches were tried by the Isangoma, who could sniff out or smell a witch, and witches practiced the dark arts of abatakhati, which is also called abatakhati. And witchcraft was unseen and unseeable. It was pointless to rely on alibis or witnesses. You could only smell out the occult power within, and before the process of smelling out, the Isangoma locked themselves up in a hut and then burst out in a frenzy to find the people of the kraal. You know the kraal, the homestead, the village? They'd be arranged in a like a half circle, a line. And then chanting with a low voice, the Isangoma would ask the spirits to help them touch the right man. And he would become excited and frenzy and dance towards the people, affecting to examine them by means of his olfactory sense. And then he'd touch the guilty one. And punishment was exile or death. And there are, of course, really strong parallels between the smelling out parade and the dog's identification parade. And these have been pointed out by anthropologist D. Hammond Took and a very good historian of policing, not dogs, but policing, Keith Scher, who pointed out that people might have had a totally different understanding of what had happened when they were smelled out. They might be confessing to something else, to feelings of jealousy or resentment that they maybe genuinely believed had caused others misfortune. They might have been confessing to evil within themselves, not to a crime. And prior to this, colonial crime solving was intensely visual. You looked for visible clues, and it was also oral and auditory. You interrogated witnesses, you asked them what they saw and heard. But now there was this new agent of detection, and forensic science met at the confluence of a far older understanding of evil. Evil was unseen. Evil was unheard. Evil could only be smelled. Well, the police were pretty happy. They closed a lot of cases, and the confessions might well have been extracted by a very different sense of what it meant to be smelled out. But equally, I think, it might have been that some believed the inverse of that. They might have thought that the dogs themselves were bewitched, or that the dogs were working under state-sanctioned witchcraft as familiars, as the bringers of evil. And they may have believed that the state had aligned with the hated abatakhati and had adopted their use of the dog as familiar, as bringer of evil. Well, all that said, one of the things that does give me confidence in the veracity of many of the police reports, I don't think there's a large-scale cover-up and conspiracy because of it, is the number of times grumpy constables noted in different cases widely separated by geography how bad a dog called Malun was at his job. While at the same time, separated by hundreds of miles, unable to look at each other's reports, they were hated Malun. He was not good. But the constables commented positively on the abilities of dogs like Truan, Maxwell, Queen, or De Wet. In particular, they were impressed by a Doberman pincher called Sauer. Sauer was a legend who died at age 9 years and 8 days in De Aar on 30th of June, 1926. And he was buried at the station by special permission of the Commissioner of Police. Sauer was homegrown. He was born and trained at the Irini Police Department. He had not been a promising puppy. He was a nervous and awkward little dog, but he thrived on the training. And that brings us to Sauer versus the Ninevites. But first, of course, a little background. When the South African police first became adopted this system and started to train the scent dogs, it was the time of the violence on the reef. Up in Johannesburg, the mining area, the industrial, the gold mines, it was a time of the gangs. And the Ninevite gang was the most powerful of the early, colonial resistance movements, or the most dangerous of the gangs, depending on which historian you talk to. They were very active from 1900 to 1920, and when the dogs started with the South African police, the Ninevite outrages were at their worst. The Ninevites were started by Nongoloza Matebula, a charismatic Zulu migrant who ended up on the reef, who built a quasi-military band of outlaws, wielding his troops together with a simple but potent ideology of banditry as anti-colonial resistance. And they have a long legacy, the Ninevites. At the moment, where I live in Cape Town or outside Cape Town, there's a low-level civil war being waged on the people by gang culture, and the worst of the gangs is the numbers gangs. And they claim direct lineage to the Ninevites. And they're currently run by a guy called, he's in jail now, he still runs it, a guy called Johnny Mungrel. And it's really funny how we can't get away from dogs. So Sauer and the Ninevites. When finally one of the Ninevites had been captured and appeared in court, in a speech from the dock, the Ninevite was called upon to plead, and he said to the judge, "My lord, what can we do now? The white man has trained dogs to become witches, and they have smelt us out." So the judge asked formally, "Does that amount to a plea of guilty?" "Not guilty, my lord," was the prompt reply, but the court smiled. Sauer was also famously called out on a spoor that was 132 hours old. And in 1925, when he was an old dog, on his last cases, he tracked a stock thief almost 100 miles across the desert landscape of the Karoo. Finally, Sauer also caught a fellow canine suspect for foul play. He caught 3 ducks went missing, okay, in Pretoria in July 1920. Sauer traced them to a neighboring yard and pointed out the canine suspect in the only case of stock theft by animal I found in the archives. His testimony was supported, it was all done very correctly, by a fellow police dog, Natalin, and the embarrassed owner of the canine criminal agreed to pay for the ducks. Even the duck that was still alive, just very bedraggled. But of course, not all dogs were Sauer. There was a remarkable rate of successful tracking, bar some persistent failures like Milan. But here I think we really must be just as cautious as we were about the confessions, because one of the reasons for this great tracking could be false alerts. So what's going on here? Well, it's pretty clear that the ancient canine ability of sniffing may be augmented by a much more recently evolved trait, the desire to please a human master or partner, and the ability to read our body language. Certainly, recent studies have shown that drug-sniffing dogs, great survey at the Chicago Tribune in 2007-2009, in a stop and search for drugs, only 44% of the cases where the dog alerted for the drug actually found the drugs. And then, when Hispanics were involved, when they were alerting and it was Hispanic suspects, only in 27% of the cases. So I think we see what is happening there. The problem is not their noses, but what they know. Lisa Litt, a neurologist who works at the University of California, Davis, says it's microsignals given by the dog handler that results in these false alerts. And Columbia University psychology professor, Andrew mentioned her yesterday, Alexandra Horitz, in an experiment testing wolves versus dogs, looking for treats, found that if you take humans out the equations, the wolves and the dogs do equally well. Put humans into the equation, the dogs do really badly, because the dogs are looking at the humans, trying to read their body language, where the treats are, and also, it's about teamwork. That's evolved as an evolutionary trait between them. They want us to help them. I'm very used to being smelled. In my house, for example, if I walk around naked, huge mistake, because Mojo will track me. silently, and then leap into my nether regions to smell the heady delights of the human bottom. But I also know about false alerting, because when I do tracking, Mojo does a lot better if my partner, Graham, knows where I'm hiding. So similarly, some of the South African police tracker dogs might well have been using not their noses, but their eyes, watching the dog handlers for clues, not the crime scene. But here's the thing. The phenomenon was completely understood in 1918. So thank you, Lisa Litt, and thank you, Alexandra Horowitz. The cops knew it in 1918. The police commissioner downwards, all the way down to the constables, detective constables, knew about the clever Hans effect, which is named, of course, after the horse, the eponymous horse, who won fame in about 1907 for stomping out the answers to simple arithmetic questions with his hoof. Hans was clever, but not at maths. Rather, he was clever at reading as humans, watching for subtle, unintentional clues from the audience and the trainer. We know it as the observer expectancy effect, but they knew it too. And this was why, as was discussed at length in 1918, in 1928, in 1930, in various commissions, in frantic telegrams, in communiques that went to every single detective constable working with dogs, to dog handlers, this was why two dogs had to be used working independently. When Maxwell sent on a case, DeVette and Queen have to wait in the patrol vans. They don't see. It was also why the dog handler was never, ever allowed to talk to the detective constable on the case. They had to never collude and have conversations about possible suspects or even the direction of the trail. As early as 1922, it was mandatory that the dog keeper was not allowed to be the one investigating the case at all. No discussion permitted with the detective constable. And there was so definitely an awareness of the dangers of the clever hounds effect. And there was a general admittance from February 1918 at the very top, the top brass, that things had escalated too far, actually, with dogs. And I quote from the commissioner directly, this came from the commissioner, "Too much appears to have been expected from the dogs in the detection of criminals. They can only be considered as adjunct to your detective staff. It must be obvious that it's for the human brain to reason and discriminate between the innocent and the criminal. The dog has only a sense of smell to guide it." Look, here's the thing. When they came in 1912, remember there were only the six cases where the people were convicted. Nobody knew what to make of dog evidence in the first 2 years. Nobody trusted it. Then there was a period of 3 or 4 years where I think they trusted it a little bit too much. They were dazzled. It seemed to be working. So they trusted it a bit too much. The dog carried too much weight. But then from 1918, it didn't. It wasn't allowed. I will say that between 1914 and 1918, I was surprised by the number of cases where people got convicted solely on the dog's word. One stood out. There was this one suspect who received 4 months hard labor based purely and solely on being identified by Max with a bark. You know, that's a problem. But by 1918, which in very technical historiographic terms, we historians call bloody early, there was a strong backlash against dogs as the sole source of evidence. The Commissioner of Police said, "No person should be deprived of liberty if the only reason for arrest is the police dog." Same year, the Secretary of Justice called for a thorough inquiry, which was repeated again and again, these commissions of inquiry, into the great experiment. By 1930, the Commissioner of Inquiry summed it up. "Certain evidence shows that the dog master can, if so minded, control the activity of a dog's by secret signals so as to make the dog point out a particular person." And from 1918, the Minister of Justice was breathing heavily down their necks. The dog keepers, the detective constables had to submit separate reports each time a dog was deployed at a crime scene. And we've ended up with the archival motherload, scores and scores of criminal cases. And the crimes are overwhelmingly stock theft, but there are others. There's rape, there's murder, there's arson, there's attempted derailment of a train. There's only two cases with women involved in the first 20 years, and both were concealment of a birth. And the dogs tracked the women from the bodies of the babies that they found. But there are other cases: housebreaking, theft by night, malicious damage to property, faction fighting up on the compounds, gang war. Eventually, the Secretary for Justice felt deluged by the reports. He said, just send them in exceptional cases. And it was then that the legal cases followed. In 1920, and here we get Rex again, not like the bloodhound Rex, but Rex meaning the state. Rex, the side of the prosecution in state, in the state trial. So it was Rex versus Trepido, the legal case. In Rex versus Trepido, the judge said the evidence of a dog is inadmissible. The conviction was quashed. In 1922, Rex versus Meraki, the evidence of the dog in a stock theft case, the evidence, the dog can't give evidence, the judge said. Famously, you can't cross-examine a dog, therefore it cannot give evidence. It's merely hearsay. By 1924, questions were raised within the police on the ground in the upper brass about being allowed to enter premises if a dog told you to. And legal opinion said you couldn't. If the dog was alerting and it was a private property, you needed other reasons to go into that property. You needed other reasonable grounds. The dog alerts wasn't enough. And the judges were absolutely clear on one point, and that was that the dogs could never be allowed to hurt anyone. In Rex versus Young Mentor was a cheese thief. He was scratched and bitten by a police dog and they were effecting arrest. And the court found in favor of Jan Mentor, in favor of the alleged criminal, and the Minister of Justice was found to be guilty, and they had to pay an enormous sum of money, £25, to the victim. The Secretary for Justice, there was contention, there was anxiety, there was skepticism, there was a lot of self-reflexivity. But there's no real need to change the law, and that was because the public had bought into dogs. They trusted dogs. They believed in dogs. And from the 20s, you see just petition after petition from individuals, from neighborhoods, and from farmers' unions writing to the commissioner, writing to the Minister of Justice, writing to their local politicians saying, dogs, 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 we need dogs. We need the dogs, particularly in stock theft cases, begging for dogs. And Colonel Trutter noticed with satisfaction the utility and success of police dogs is becoming widely known among the farmers and the people. Consequently, there's a demand for their services within the union and without dogs. People were starting to come from southern Rhodesia, from neighboring states, Kenya, coming to see the dogs. The other matter was public opinion and professional prestige. In 1912, no one wanted to become a dog handler or a dog keeper. By 1926, people were keen. It was prestigious. There was even a case of the fabulously named Detective Clue, who applied for a job, turned down, not good enough. People wanted, it was prestigious. People were prestigious. So by 1947, this is what I do for you. In 1947, the royal visit, Princess Elizabeth and also the King, came to my humble country. And one of the things we showed them was the dog training center at Quakersport. It was an object, a place, a symbol of national pride. By mid-20th century, it was really of quite international renown. It was one of a kind in the world. It was one of the, at some points, it was the only state-owned and managed dog training facility for police dogs in the world. Dogs were being sent out around the world internationally, dogs that had been trained there, and police officers were coming from all over the world also. Pakistan, Palestine, Europe, to be trained there as well with the techniques. It's a point of pride. It was the peak of Quakersport. But then, of course, things changed. And this was because of a change in policing itself under the increasingly heavy hand of the apartheid state. Officially, apartheid came in 1948. But things went really, really bad at the start of the 1960s. We had the Sharpeville massacre, when people were just protesting African protest, you know, against some of the insidious apartheid laws. The police couldn't deal with the crowd, and they shot and killed 69 African protesters. The United Nations then issued the condemnatory resolution against South Africa. And there was a real change, a deepening and a worsening. So, in 1961, the South African police went on a study tour. They sent Colonel Brink and Warrant Officer Killian to Europe to report back. And they wanted to find out how Europe was dealing with urban areas. They wanted a different kind of dog, a different kind of dog handler. They wanted patrol dogs. They wanted crowd control dogs. They wanted defense dogs. They wanted attack dogs. And they wanted them for urban areas now, not rural areas. So from 1962, these new dogs came. And they were attached to the flying squad in the urban centers in Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban. These dogs were German shepherds. They were a new technology. They were a force multiplier, but with the emphasis on force. And the idea was to use them, of course, in political crowd control as resistance to apartheid escalated. And the dogs were everywhere. In 1963, when they captured the ANC, the African National Congress, the ANC, when they captured the ANC underground, and the arrest that led to Mandela's Rivonia trial, took 15 security branch men and one dog. You see them everywhere. A year after the bringing in of these new dogs, there were only 164 tracker dogs and 234 patrol dogs, this new type. Over the next few years, I think, what I've got, is that tracker dogs were used in 3,000 cases. The patrol dogs, the new dogs, were used in 13,141 cases. It was a new kind of policing. It needed a new kind of handler, a new kind of training, and that meant a new kind of dog. And the point that comes out for me, out of the archives and out of this very, very strongly, is that there's no such thing as a dog. It is meaningless to speak of dogs. It is like when, you know, sociobiologists speak of this thing called human nature. It's really a weird 1950s fantasy of what men and women are like. It's meaningless. Dogs are, they exist only historically. There is no rarefied essence called dog. There's no unchanging and eternal dogness. You cannot reach out and touch the face of dog. Dogs are like us. Dogs are products of biology and evolution for sure, but they're also products of history and culture. And they're so closely co-constituted with us. We breed them, we feed them, we train them, and they watch us. So dogs are as historical as we are. And that brings us also to acts of dog, to acts of dog. What we have here is a class of agencies. On the one hand, the police initially, those first few years, the police initially gave the dogs too much agency. And you see it in cases like Rex versus Jan Mentor. You know, the case of the scratching and the biting. That dog was allowed to do too much. It was given the right to do a certain kind of policing. And then also the police were letting them do too much in selecting and providing all the evidence for and the testimony for in those first 3-4 years in solving the crime. And even the suspects gave the dogs too much agency, maybe, by saying they were witch smellers or maybe witches themselves. But that notion of agency, and that's the point, was hotly and rapidly contested all the way to the Supreme Court. And this presents a much more complicated understanding of agencies that is much more friable and complex and brittle. And that's really, really important in understanding change over time. Prior to 1960, prior to the heavy hand of apartheid on the straining, flimsy leash of the dogs of terror, there was a period of 50 years, 50 lost years, where things like agency were debated and contested. Apartheid's dogs were not inevitable. And this is why you have historians. This is the greatest strength, and really, that we have as historians. It's the ability, especially in a country in crisis, it's the ability to take an apparently immutable status quo, President Zuma's opening statements about dogs and their meaning, and to simply prove that it was not always so. It's amazingly powerful. It lets us challenge the existing order that might otherwise seem, you know, biological, incontrovertible, or, incontestable, inevitable. Because if it has changed before, it can be changed again. And this is the quiet activism of historians. It is the protest politics of people who like archives and armchairs and tweed jackets. So, what is clear? What is clear? Ooh, get there now. What is clear is, let me show you something else. What is clear is that there's a large meta-narrative, of oppressive policing, and the role of the state has overshadowed the smaller stories of the intimate relationship between humans and dogs and the visceral reality of their powers. We started this talk with the vicious running dogs of the apartheid state, but we have forgotten, and we must now remember, the 50 years between 1911 and 1961, when the dogs were used for their noses and not for their teeth or their claws. And the shadow of what came later, the looming telos of apartheid, the iron fist, has obscured the achievement of the men and dogs of Kwaggafontein. That blunt telos obscures the contemporaneous doubt, the brittleness, the experimentation, the self-reflexivity of the early days of detection by smell. And so what is lost? What is lost is how Dogmaster Cope's heart beat when he thought of the good dog's nose. And what is lost is how Sauer tracked the stock thief 99 miles in McCrew and found the stock. What is lost is understanding that intimate triad between the dog handler and the two dogs. What is lost is knowing how it worked. What is lost is knowing how Sauer found the ducks. But in the shift from nose to teeth, so much was lost. And so I hope you'll forgive me again for being a little bit self-indulgent again. I want to go back to the choice I faced between the two puppies. The dog, the big dog for size and swagger who could keep me safe. And then Rio, a dog who was simply curious about the world. And it was uncanny how it paralleled the choices made in apartheid policing. And I too had to choose between teeth and nose too. And I've chosen Rio. I've chosen to believe South Africa needs dogs like Rio. And I wanted to see where smell would take us. And I've decided that instead of doing defensive or attack training with Rio, as I've done with another dog, we are going to train as a search and rescue team to operate in the mountains above my little university town of Stellenbosch. We're surrounded by mountains. And the idea is we're going to train as a search and rescue team. Search and rescue is not alien to a historian. It's more or less what we're paid to do. It's just the people are dead. And it's fascinating how at the moment I'm following the teaching of exactly 100 years ago, the Kwaggafontein protocol. And obviously that's going to be augmented by newer methods when Rio joins the search and rescue program when she's 5 months old. She's only 14 weeks old at the moment. But interestingly, it's already clear to me that not that much has changed. I'm currently using the orders written by the old dog master himself, Cornelius Caper. And for me, this is an act of faith. Maybe it's an act of hope. With Rio, just as in my work as a historian and as a citizen, I want to find again what has been lost. Thank you.